This is an MP3 audio clip from the weekly People First radio broadcast.
CHLY 101.7 FM, Vancouver Island. On the web, www.chly.ca.
The ghostly Christmas story about Ebenezer Scrooge and his conversion from miserable miser to generous goodfellow has not only interested readers for generations, the book has also inspired a range of films, including a current 3D version by Disney. A Christmas Carol was written at a time when Charles Dickens may have been concerned about his own future. He had a large family to care for, a large home in London to maintain, and Christmas was approaching.
Dickens' writing is filled with social justice themes, and his novels became so popular it seems possible that he may have indirectly inspired changes in social policy. We're going to take a look at social justice, past and present, with the help of Vancouver Island University professor Terry Doughty and actors Katja Van Loon, Bryce Hughes, William McCallum, Kieran Hunt, and Coralie Draginda, who are students in VIU's theater program.
We're focusing today on three works of literature from 1840s Britain. Two of Dickens' series of Christmas books, A Christmas Carol, published in 1844, and The Chimes, published in 1845. But we're going to begin with a book written by Thomas Carlyle, published in 1843, called Past and Present.
Of these successful, skillful workers, some 2 million, it is now counted, sit in workhouses, poor law prisons, or have outdoor relief flung over the wall to them. The workhouse Bastille being filled to bursting, and the strong poor law broken asunder by a stronger. They sit there, these many months now, their hope of deliverance as yet small, in workhouses pleasantly so named, because work cannot be done in them. 1,200,000 workers in England alone, their cunning right hand lamed, lying idle in their sorrowful bosom, their hopes, outlooks, share of this fair world, shut in by narrow walls. They sit there, pent up, as in a kind of horrid enchantment, glad to be imprisoned and enchanted, that they may not perish starved. The picturesque tourist, in a sunny autumn day, through this bounteous realm of England, describes the Union workhouse on his path. Passing by the workhouse of St. Ives in Huntingdonshire, on a bright day last autumn, says the picturesque tourist, I saw sitting on wooden benches in front of their Bastille, and within their ring walls and its railings, some 500 or more of these men, tall, robust figures, mostly young or of middle age, of honest countenance, many of them thoughtful and even intelligent-looking men. They sat there, near by one another, but in a kind of torpor, especially in a silence, which was very striking. In silence, for, alas, what word was to be said? An earth all lying round, crying, come and till me, come and reap me, yet we here sit enchanted. In the eyes and brows of these men hung the gloomiest expression, not of anger, but of grief and shame and manifold inarticulate distress and weariness. They returned my glance with a glance that seemed to say, do not look at us. We sit enchanted here, we know not why. The sun shines and the earth calls, and by the governing powers and impotences of this England, we are forbidden to obey. It is impossible, they tell us. There was something that reminded me of Dante's hell in the look of all this, and I rode swiftly away.
Terry, perhaps you could talk about this hell that Thomas Carlyle was talking about.
Dante Alighieri was an Italian poet of the 14th century, and in his Divine Comedy, he has a section called the Inferno in which the poet visits hell. At the gate, there's the famous inscription, abandon all hope, ye who enter here. And he progresses through hell in ever-lowering circles until he reaches the very bottom, which is where Satan is held, frozen. And that's what we see with these workers. They are frozen. They're not able to work.
Carlyle's disdain for economists and economics was, it is reported, well known. He's the person who characterized economics as the dismal science. Here's some comments on what society had, in his eyes, become.
True, it must be owned. We, for the present, with our mammon gospel, have come to strange conclusions. We call it a society, and go about professing openly the totalist separation, isolation. Our life is not a mutual helpfulness, but rather, cloaked under the due laws of war, named fair competition and so forth, it is a mutual hostility. We have profoundly forgotten everywhere that cash payment is not the sole relation of human beings. We think, nothing doubting, that it absolves all and liquidates all engagements of man. My starving workers, answers the rich mill owner, did I not hire them fairly in the market? Did I not pay them the last sixpence, the sum covenanted for? What have I to do with them more? Verily, mammon worship is a melancholy creed. When Cain, for his own behoof, had killed Abel, and was questioned, where is thy brother? He too made answer, am I my brother's keeper? Did I not pay my brother his wages? The thing he had merited from me.
Tell us more about the gospel of mammonism, Terry.
Mammon is an idol representing wealth. And for Carlyle, he's really talking about a society which worships the notion of getting and spending money. So for him, the gospel of mammonism is materialism. He's talking about a laissez-faire economic society, which is very like our free market economy, in which people are essentially thinking of themselves as individuals solely and thinking first and foremost about their material well-being.
The 1840s were difficult years in Britain. The decade is sometimes referred to as the Hungry 1840s. In the mid-1840s, several harvests failed across Europe, which caused famines. The Great Irish Famine from 1845 to 1849 was especially severe, and a quarter of Ireland's population either died or immigrated to the United States and Canada. An economic panic in 1837, triggered by failing banks in America, was followed by a severe depression lasting until 1845.
It was during this decade that Charles Dickens wrote his series of five Christmas books between 1843 and 1848. The first of these books, the most famous, is A Christmas Carol, and we'll return with some scenes from A Christmas Carol later. But we start with a scene from Dickens' second Christmas book, The Chimes, written in 1844.
Toby Veck is a poor man in his early 60s who ekes out a living as a messenger or ticket porter and is willing to sleep and stand in front of the church door to wait for his job. We join him as he waits outside in the cold on New Year's Eve.
Chimes were very often in his ears, and very often in his thoughts, but always in his good opinion, and he very often got such a crick in his neck by staring with his mouth wide open at the steeple where they hung, that he was fain to take an extra trot or two afterwards to cure it. The very thing Toby was in the act of doing one cold day, when the last drowsy sound of 12 o'clock, just struck, was humming like a melodious monster of a bee, and not by any means a busy bee, all through the steeple.
"Dinner time, eh?"
said Toby, trotting up and down before the church.
"Ah."
Toby's nose was very red, and his eyelids were very red, and he winked very much, and his shoulders were very near his ears, and his legs were very stiff, and altogether he was evidently a long way upon the frosty side of cool.
"Dinner time, eh?"
repeated Toby, using his right-hand muffler like an infantine boxing glove, and punishing his chest for being cold. He took a silent trot after that for a minute or two.
"There's nothing,"
said Toby, breaking forth afresh. but here he stopped short in his trot, and with a face of great interest and some alarm, felt his nose carefully all the way up. It was but a little way, not being much of a nose, and he had soon finished.
"I thought it was gone,"
said Toby, trotting off again.
"It's all right, however. I'm sure I couldn't blame it if it was to go. It has a precious hard service of it in the bitter weather, and precious little to look forward to, for I don't take any snuff myself. It's a good deal tried, poor creature, at the best of times, for when it does get hold of a present whiff or so, which ain't too often, it's generally from somebody else's dinner or coming home from the baker's."
The reflection reminded him of that other reflection, which he had left unfinished.
"There's nothing more regular in its coming round than dinner time, and nothing less regular in its coming round than dinner. That's the great difference between 'em. It's took me a long time to find it out. I wonder whether it would be worth any gentleman's while now to buy that observation for the papers or the Parliament."
Toby was only joking, for he gravely shook his head in self-depreciation.
"Why, Lord, the papers is full of observations now as it is, and so's the Parliament. Here's the last week's paper now."
Taking a very dirty paper from his pocket and holding it from him at arm's length.
"Full of observations. Full of 'em. I like to know the news as well as any man,"
said Toby, slowly, folding it a little smaller and putting it in his pocket again.
"But it almost goes against the grain with me to read a paper now. It frightens me almost. I don't know what we poor people are coming to. Lord send we may be coming to something better in the new year nigh upon us."
"Why, father, father," said a pleasant voice, hard by. But Toby, not hearing it, continued to trot backwards and forwards, musing as he went, and talking to himself.
"It seems as if we can't go right, or do right, or be righted. I hadn't much schooling myself when I was young, and I can't make out whether we have any business on this face, on the face of this earth or not. Sometimes I think we must have a little, and sometimes I think we must be intruding. I get so puzzled sometimes that I am not even able to make up my mind whether there is any good in us at all, or whether we are born bad. We seem to be dreadful things. We seem to give a great deal of trouble. We're always being complained of and guarded against. One way or another, we fill the papers. Talk of New Year! I can bear up as well as another man at most times, better than a good many, for I am as strong as a lion, and all men ain't. But supposing it should really be that we have no right to a New Year, supposing we really are intruding..."
Terry, Toby seems to be wondering whether poor people have a right to existence, and he's basing his observations on what he's reading in the paper. What's your comment on that?
The papers tended to sensationalize stories of poor people who, in their despair, committed crime. So, for instance, the story that inspired this incident is the case of Mary Furley, a seamstress who tried to drown herself and her baby in the Thames. She survived the incident and the baby did not. So she was put on trial for murder and was sentenced to be hung. There was such a popular outcry at this that she was eventually had her sentence commuted. Carlyle talks as well about parents who were on trial for murder, for poisoning a child for burial money so that they can afford to pay the remaining children, to feed the remaining children in the family. So essentially the papers present the poor as uncivilized and savage, immoral and wicked.
A little later in the novel, Toby is joined by his daughter, Meg, and then by her fiancé, Richard, and the three of them have an encounter with a city official, an alderman, and two of his companions. In this, another scene from Charles Dickens' book, The Chimes.
"Now you know,"
said the alderman, addressing his two friends, with a self-complacent smile upon his face which was habitual to him.
"I'm a plain man, and a practical man. And I go to work in a plain, practical way. That's my way. There is not the least mystery or difficulty in dealing with this sort of people, if only you understand them. and can talk to him in their own manner. Now you, Porter, don't you ever tell me, or anybody else, my friend, that you haven't always enough to eat. And of the best, because I know better. I have tasted your tripe, you know. And you can't chafe me. Do you understand that, what that word means? Chafe, eh? That's the right word, isn't it? Ah, Lord bless you.
Said the alderman, turning to his friends again.
It's the easiest thing on earth to deal with this sort of people, if you understand them.
Famous man for the common people, Alderman Cute. Never out of temper with them. Easy, affable, joking, knowing gentleman.
You see, my friend, there's a great deal of nonsense talked about want. Hard up, you know. That's the phrase, isn't it? And I intend to put it down. There's a certain amount of cant in vogue about starvation, and I mean to put it down. That's all. Lord bless you.
Said the alderman, turning to his friends again.
You may put down anything among this sort of people, if only you know the way to set about it.
Toby took Meg's hand and drew it through his arm. He didn't seem to know what he was doing, though.
Your daughter, eh?
Said the alderman, chucking her familiarly under the chin. Always affable with the working classes, Alderman Cute. Knew what pleased them. Not a bit of pride.
Where's her mother?
Dead. Her mother got up linen and was called to heaven when she was born.
Not to get up linen there, I suppose.
Toby might or might not have been able to separate his wife in heaven from her old pursuits. But query, if Mrs. Alderman Cute had gone to heaven, would Mr. Alderman Cute have pictured her as holding any state or station there?
And you're making love to her, are you?
Said Cute to the young youth.
Yes,
returned Richard quickly, for he was nettled by the question.
And we're going to be married on New Year's Day.
What do you mean, married?
Why, yes, we're thinking of it, Master. We're rather in a hurry, you see, in case you should put it, we should be put down first.
Put that down indeed, Alderman, and you'll do something. Married? Married? The ignorance of the first principles of political economy on the part of these people. Their improvidence, their wickedness is, by heavens, enough to... Now look at that couple, will you?
Well, they were worth looking at, and marriage seemed as reasonable and fair a deed as they need have in contemplation.
A man may live to be as old as Methuselah, and may labor all his life for the benefit of such people as those, and may heap up facts on figures, facts on figures, facts on figures, mountains high and dry, and he can no more hope to persuade him than that they have no right or business to be married than he can hope to persuade him that they have no earthly right or business to be born. And that we know they haven't. We reduce it to a mathematical certainty long ago.
Alderman Cute was mightily diverted, and laid his right forefinger on the side of his nose, as much as to say to both his friends, "Observe me, will you? Keep your eye on the practical man," and called Meg to him.
Come here, my girl.
The young blood of her lover had been mounting wrathfully within the last few minutes, and he was indisposed to let her come, but setting a constraint upon himself, he came forward with a stride as Meg approached and stood beside her. Toby kept her hand within his arm still, but looked from face to face as wildly as a sleeper in a dream.
Now I'm going to give you a word or two of good advice, my girl. It's my place to give advice, you know, because I'm a justice. You know I'm a justice, don't you?
Yes.
But everybody knew Alderman Cute was a justice. Oh, dear, so active a justice always. Who's such a mode of brightness in the public eye as Cute?
You are going to be married, you say. Very unbecoming and indelicate of one of your sex. But never mind that. After you are married, you'll quarrel with your husband and come to be a distressed wife. You may think not, but you will, because I tell you so. Now, I give you fair warning that I have made up my mind to put distressed wives down. So don't be brought before me. You'll have children. Boys. Those boys will grow up bad, of course, and run wild in the streets, without shoes and stockings. Mind, my young friend, I'll convict them summarily, every one, for I am determined to put boys without shoes and stockings down. Perhaps your husband will die young, most likely, and leave you with a baby. Then you'll be turned out of doors and wander up and down the streets. Now don't wander near me, my dear, for I am resolved to put all wandering mothers down. All young mothers of all sorts and kinds, it's my determination to put down. Don't think to plead illness as an excuse with me, or babies as an excuse with me. For all sick persons and young children, I am determined to put down. And if you attempt, desperately and ungratefully and impiously and fraudulently attempt, to drown yourself or hang yourself, I'll have no pity for you, for I have made up my mind to put all suicide down. If there is one thing on which I can be said to have made up my mind more than on any other, it is to put suicide down. So don't try it on. That is the phrase, isn't it? How we understand each other now.
Toby knew not whether to be agonized or glad to see that Meg had turned a deadly white and dropped her lover's hand.
"And as for you, you dull dog,"
said the alderman, turning with even increased cheerfulness and urbanity to the young smith.
"What are you thinking of being married for? What do you want to be married for, you silly fellow? If I was a fine young strapping chap like you, I should be ashamed of being milksop enough to pin myself to a woman's apron strings. Why, she'll be an old woman before you're a middle-aged man, and a pretty figure you'll cut then with a draggle-tailed wife and a crowd of squalling children crying after you wherever you go."
Oh, he knew how to banter the common people, Alderman Cute.
"There, go along with you and repent. Don't make such a fool of yourself as to get married on New Year's Day. You'll think very differently of it long before next New Year's Day, a trim fellow like you with all the girls looking after you. There, go along with you."
They went along, not arm in arm or hand in hand or interchanging bright glances, but she in tears, he gloomy and down-looking. Were these the hearts that had so lately made old Toby's leap up from its faintness? No, no. The alderman, a blessing on his head, had put them down.
Terry, what does Alderman Cutie have to tell us about attitudes towards poverty during that time?
Cute is based on Sir Peter Lorry, a Middlesex magistrate notorious for his campaigns to put down various sins of the poor. His attitude here is that of the 1840s generally, of the status quo, that notion that the poor have somehow earned and deserve their fate. They've been incompetent, perhaps, in their ability to earn a living. They've been improvident in their wastefulness of eating things like tripe, for example, or they've been improvident as well in trying to marry young. There's a dominant notion of the time that there is a problem of surplus population, and of course the surplus is located at the lower end of the social scale, and so there's this idea that the poor have really kind of made their own situation, and the treatment of them is essentially very punitive in this time period. The New Poor Law of 1834, the work houses, essentially try to criminalize poverty, make it so unpleasant to be poor. But really, the society doesn't offer people with any real opportunity for improving their situations.
We turn now to A Christmas Carol and its opening scene. Here, Ebenezer Scrooge is in his counting house with his clerk, Bob Cratchit. It's Christmas Eve, and two gentlemen have just dropped by with a request.
"Scrooge and Marley's, I believe,"
said one of the gentlemen, referring to his list.
"Have I the pleasure of addressing Mr. Scrooge or Mr. Marley?"
"Mr. Marley has been dead these 7 years. He died 7 years ago this very night."
"We have no doubt his liberality is well represented by his surviving partner,"
said the gentleman, presenting his credentials. It certainly was, for they had been two kindred spirits. At an ominous word, liberality, Scrooge frowned and shook his head and handed the credentials back.
"At this festive season of the year, Mr. Scrooge, it is more than usually desirable that we should make some slight provision for the poor and destitute, who suffer greatly at this present time. Many thousands are in want of common necessaries. Hundreds of thousands are in want of common comfort, sir."
"Are there no prisons?"
"Plenty of prisons."
"And the union workhouses, are they still in operation?"
"They are. Still, I wish I could say they were not."
"The treadmill and the poor law are in full vigor, then?"
"Both very busy, sir."
"Oh, I was afraid from what you said at first that something had occurred to stop them in their useful course. I'm very glad to hear it."
"Under the impression that they scarcely furnish Christian cheer of mind or body to the multitude, a few of us are endeavoring to raise a fund to buy the poor some meat and drink and means of warmth. We choose this time because it is a time of all others when want is keenly felt and abundance rejoices. What shall I put you down for?"
"Nothing."
"You wish to be anonymous?"
"I wish to be left alone. Since you ask me what I wish, gentlemen, that is my answer. I don't make merry myself at Christmas, and I can't afford to make idle people merry. I help to support the establishments I have mentioned. They cost enough, and those who are badly off must go there."
"Well, many can't go there, and many would rather die."
"If they would rather die, they had better do it and decrease the surplus population." Besides, excuse me, I don't know that.
But you might know it.
It's not my business. It's enough for a man to understand his own business and not to interfere with other people's. Mine occupies me constantly. Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Seeing clearly that it would be useless to pursue their point, the gentleman withdrew. Scrooge resumed his labors with an improved opinion on himself and a more facetious temper than was usual with him.
We know that A Christmas Carol has become an enduring classic, a book that has never been out of print from the time it was first released. Terry, what kind of contemporary effect did Dickens' many novels have?
Dickens called A Christmas Carol a sledgehammer to attack the teachings of political economy that dehumanized the poor. Really, though, you can't entirely connect Dickens with any particular legislation that changed society. But what I think he really does do well is he gets at people's emotions. He insists on connectedness against his culture's focus on individualism. And he insists on the humanity of the poor. He makes them real. He makes their stories pathetic. And I think that creates a climate in which social change can happen. In his autobiographical novel, David Copperfield, he has David say early on that, I prayed that I might not be houseless anymore and might never forget the houseless. And that's really what Dickens did. He did not allow his society to forget the houseless.
After a tumultuous night during which Ebenezer Scrooge is visited by the ghost of his dead business partner and three ghosts in succession representing Christmas's past, present, and future, Scrooge awakens to a new day and what seems to be a new way of living.
He dressed himself all in his best and at last got out into the streets. The people were by this time pouring forth, as he had seen with the ghost of Christmas present, and walking with his hands behind him, Scrooge regarded everyone with a delightful smile. He looked so irresistibly pleasant, in a word, that three or four good-humored fellows said, "Good morning, sir, a Merry Christmas to you." And Scrooge said afterwards, often afterwards, that of all the blithe sounds he had ever heard, those were the blithest in his ears. He had not gone far when, coming towards him, he beheld the portly gentleman who had walked into the counting house the day before and said, "Scrooge and Marley, I believe." It sent pangs across his heart to think that how this gentleman would look upon him when they met, but he knew that the path lay straight before him, and he took it.
"My dear sir,"
said Scrooge, quickening his pace and taking the old gentleman by his hands.
"How do you do? I hope you succeeded yesterday. It was very kind of you. A Merry Christmas to you, sir."
"Mr. Scrooge?"
"Yes, that is my name, and I fear it may not be pleasant to you. Allow me to ask your pardon, and will you have the goodness?"
Here Scrooge whispered in his ear,
"Lord bless me! My dear Mr. Scrooge, are you serious?"
"If you please, not a farthing less. A great many back payments are included in it, I assure you. Will you do me that favor?"
"My dear sir, I don't know what to say to such beautiful..."
"Don't say anything, please. Come and see me. Will you come and see me?"
"I will,"
said the gentleman, and it was clear he meant to do it.
"Thank you. I'm much obliged to you. I thank you 50 times. Bless you."
He went to the church and walked about the street and watched the people hurry to and fro and patted children on the head and questioned beggars and looked down into the kitchens of houses and looked up in the windows and found that everything could yield him pleasure. He had never dreamed that any walk, that anything, could give him so much happiness.
We'd like to thank Terry Doughty, who is professor at Vancouver Island University, for taking the time today to join us. And a big thank you to Katja Van Loon, Kieran Hunt, Bryce Hughes, William McCollum, and Coralie Draginda, who played the roles of the narrators and characters in the scenes presented today. We close out our segment on social justice, past and present, with the final scene from Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol.
Screw. Scrooge was early at the office the next morning. Oh, he was early there. If he could only be there first to catch Bob Cratchit coming in late. That was the thing he had set his heart upon. And he did it. Yes, he did. The clock struck 9. No Bob. A quarter past. No Bob. It was a full 18 minutes and a half behind his time. Scrooge sat with the door wide open that he might see him come into the tank. His hat was off before he opened the door. His comforter, too. He was on a stool in a jiffy, driving away at his papers as he was trying to make overtake 9 o'clock.
"Hello,"
growled Scrooge in his accustomed voice, as near as he could feign it.
"What do you mean by coming here at this time of day?"
"I'm very sorry, sir. I am behind my time."
"You are? Yes, I think you are. Step this way, sir, if you please."
"It's only once a year, sir. It shall not be repeated. I was making rather merry yesterday, sir."
"Now I'll tell you what, my friend. I'm not going to stand this sort of thing any longer. And therefore... therefore, I am about to raise your salary."
Bob trembled and got a little nearer to the ruler. He had a momentary idea of knocking Scrooge down with it, holding him and calling the people of the court to help him with the straight waistcoat.
"Merry Christmas, Bob,"
said Scrooge, in an earnestness that could not be mistaken, as he clapped him on the back.
"A merrier Christmas, Bob, my good fellow, than I have given you for many a year. I'll raise your salary and endeavor to assist your struggling family. I will discuss your affairs this very afternoon over a Christmas bowl of smoking bishop, Bob. Make up the fires and buy another coal scuttle before you dot another I, Bob Cratchit."
Scrooge was better than his word. He did it all and infinitely more. He became as good a friend, as good a master, as good a man as the good old town knew, or any other good old city, town, or borough in this good old world. Some people laughed to see this alteration in him, but he let them laugh and little heeded them, for he was wise enough to know that nothing ever happened in this globe for good at which people did not have their little fill of laughter in the outset. And knowing that such as these would be blind anyway, he thought it quite as well that they should wrinkle their eyes in a grin and have the malady in a less attractive forms. His own heart laughed, and that was enough for him.
First Radio is an initiative of Columbian Centrist Society in partnership with Radio Malaspina Society's CHLY 101.7 FM, CHLY.ca, community radio from Nanaimo, British Columbia. The opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily of these organizations.